Welcome to The Mothers, a podcast that centers the voices of women from across America whose children were killed by police. I'm independent journalist Georgia Fort.
And I'm Nico Georgiadis of Unicorn Riot. During this episode, we hear from Monte Benjamin, whose son Javis was killed by Sergeant Lynn Thomas of the Avondale Estates Police Department in DeKalb County, Georgia. And this was in 2013. Javis' case has many of the trademarks involved in police killings that we've seen consistently. Fear of the black man, a narrative spin to demonize the victim, no accountability, and a promotion for the officer involved. In this case, Thomas was promoted to the police chief.
And when we spoke to Monte, she told us more about who Javis was. He was a student, an audio engineer who worked for a church, a teacher, a community volunteer who worked with youth at the Boys and Girls Club.
I will first give my name. My name is Monte Benjamin, and my son's name is Javis Benjamin. He was 20 years old. He was a student at Georgia Perimeter College. My son was an audio engineer. He was a mass communication student. He worked at the Boys and Girls Club in South Cobb. He did visual arts to the young people between the ages of 8 to 12 in the after-school program. He painted a mural for his senior class at Towers High School for the 2011 Titans at Towers High School, as well as he was an engineer trained by the church that he was raised up in, where I have pictures at the age of 15 where he was doing my church that I attend. The church seat 10,000. He was actually doing the soundboard during the church service. It has the date and everything, because he had a passion for production as well as audio engineering. They assist him with getting his certification. Upon the certification, he was employed at the time he was killed at another large-sized church where he was actually getting paid to do those services as well. So him as a person, he was very creative, very good at art, freehand, and graffiti, tag, and all of that stuff. So as an individual, his passion was for the kids.
A bit later in this episode, we'll hear Monte talk about how some of the youth that Javis worked with reacted to his death. Again, something we talk about frequently is residual impacts of police terror and how widespread and continually hard to deal with that they are.
But first, we're going to hear from Monte about what happened to her son, or at least how she's been able to piece together what happened to him based on evidence and what's been told to her by police.
On the day of the incident, Javis apparently ran a red light, lost control of the car he was driving, hit dead into a telephone pole. And once he hit into the pole, upon hitting the pole, he hit another car, which smashed in the driver's side of the car that he was driving. So at that time, the officer saw him run the red light, which the officer spoke back to dispatcher, told the dispatcher, he's going 120 miles an hour. I'm going to go see where he's at. Upon the arrival of the officer at the scene, my son was seen climbing out of the car. When the officer pulled up, it is on his dash cam video. He exits his car, gets out padding left, right, and then he drawed his gun on my son, who were getting out of the car. Upon my son getting out of the car, my son had both of his hands up. When he hit the telephone pole, he knocked the power out. So the residents in the neighborhood began to come out of their homes. As they were coming out of their home, my son was engaging with the people in the community. As he engaged with the people in the community, the officer was at an angle towards my son. So when he was at that angle, my son had his hands up saying, do y'all, he was pointing at the officer, but he was looking outward. Do y'all see this shit? Do y'all see what he's trying to do to me? He said it three times. Upon the last time he said it, he tilted towards the officer who was facing him. And at that point, that's when the officer shot him and he dropped to the ground. So from there, once he was killed, he initially dropped to the ground. That's when the officer initially called in. And at the time, the officers that followed up or backed up, they put their cars in an angle around my son who was on the ground, and they initially allowed him to stay there. My son, from what I remember after finally seeing hearing the video, he gasped a couple of times. But the paramedics, when they came up, screaming, telling the officers to move their car so that they can get to my son. So that's what happened to the actual scene. I was told that he assaulted the officer. They charged him with theft by taking, saying that he carjacked the car and that he assaulted the officer. I was also told that he assaulted the officer. The officer had to be transported to Grady Hospital because he had an abrasion. Yet when we found out that none of that occurred, that at the scene from the video cam that we saw, you could see where his supervisor, whoever, took his gun, and he was like, it happened so fast, it happened so fast. Yet none of what we were told on the actual day that it happened was nothing from what nothing I saw.
We've been hearing from Monte Benjamin about the story of her son, Javis, a 20-year-old killed by police in Georgia.
Now, 2 years after Javis was killed, a civil grand jury found that the case should be sent to a criminal grand jury, although it never was. This is the grand jury that Monte is speaking about in this next soundbite. During the proceedings, she was able to watch videos of her son being killed.
The day of the grand jury strongly advised indictment of the officer. The district attorney announced in a press release that they was going to carry the officer before a criminal grand jury. A warrant would be be issued, and he would go before a criminal grand jury within the next month. He waited a year later, overruled the decision, and stated that the jurors needed to be trained in order to view a police-involved shooting. And then 6 months from that day, the officer was promoted from a sergeant to chief of police. And then I was told by the district attorney that my son lost his rights as a citizen as it applies to stand your ground law because the officer feared for his life. My son was unarmed, had no form of weapon or anything, but because he turned towards the officer, that's where the fear transpired, and he was given that 2 second stand your ground right. In the state of Georgia, at the time, the Governor Deal had made an amendment to the stand your ground that officers have a 2 second immunity to any cause of lethal force. If they fear in any way within those 2 seconds, then they receive total immunity.
You're listening to episode 4 of the Mothers Podcast, presented by Unicorn Riot, featuring host Georgia Fort and Nico Georgiadis. Music in this episode is by DJ Skiz, raps by MC Longshot, recording by Malcolm Wells, and post-production by Different Worlds Music Group.
Now, Nico and I ran into Monte sometime after first hearing her story and heard an update in her case and some of her efforts pushing for police accountability through changes in the law.
I'm still at a place where, because my case was in that appeal state, I still want to see whatever I can to get the case reopened, because my reason for that is too also, it was the GBI in Atlanta that gave me the motivation to continue to pursue for justice, because the police false narratives were that my son had assaulted the officer and stole a car. But after talking with the GBI, they said that they could not discuss the case, but that they felt that I should have all three videos from the district attorney's office, the GBI, and as well as the police officer. So based on that, me having to wait that 2.5 years, when I waited those 2.5 years, that's when we found out none of what the report said happened. What actually happened was that Javis ran a red light and wrecked the car, and he climbed out of the car, and that's when the officer told him to get back in the wrecked car. He swiped away the glass, and that's when he's wanted to say that Javis assaulted him, because he was knocking the glass out of the way, but yet he was 6 feet away from Javis. And when Javis got out of the car, that's when he initially shot him in the heart. So from there, with the case of Ahmaud Arbery, though he was chased and shot, the grand jury voted in the same way that they did for Javis, but then yet, because of the special prosecutors, which is in the same bill that Hank Johnson presented, that special prosecutors need to come in along with attorney generals within a state to do those certain cases, that's when they got the ruling where all three of those men were actually charged with murder. So in the same instance, that's why I want that special grand jury presented. Though I may never know if that could be possibly done for Javis, but at the same time, it was the same type of situation. It was a jury of his peers that actually unanimously voted that this man should have been strongly indicted and should have been arrested the following day, but the district attorney chose not to, which we're now finding out that those district attorneys were being paid through the police unions. So that's why they were basically guarding the police officer instead of the citizens, in which they're supposed to do as far as their jobs. So apparently they was in his pocket.
This is Monte speaking, and this was her speaking about how hard it is to come across accountability. And she brings up some really interesting points that we've seen sort of play out. And now you know a little bit more about this and some of the corruptness in Georgia, the state of Georgia. Now, that's where her son was killed, and this is what she's facing. And as we already mentioned, the officer who killed Javis ended up being a police chief. There's a lot of situations going on in Georgia. Help us out here, Georgia.
Well, so I used to live in Georgia, and one thing I'll say is, even in following the Ahmaud Arbery situation, right, there was evidence in that specific case, which also happened in Georgia, that showed accountability for police is bigger than just charging and convicting the officers, because there's a system that works together to ensure that these officers are not held accountable. And so looking at even the district attorney, Jackie Johnson, who ended up being charged for obstructing justice, and not just in the case of the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, but also if you look into Kelsey Rayner, just do a quick search on Kelsey Rayner. Jackie Johnson also played a role in helping people who worked at the jail where Kelsey died, helping them avoid accountability and responsibility. So it's not just about the police departments, the police chiefs. Also, now here we're seeing evidence of attorneys who have also been complicit in allowing these killings to happen.
But the spin came that my son stole the car and that he physically assaulted the officer. The spin was that my son assaulted the officer. The officer feared for his life. He was a big black male that hovered over him. So once the officer feared for his life, that's when they shot him.
Being black in America feels like I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Being black in America feels like I'll never be free. I'll never be free. I'll never be free. Being black in America feels like feels like I can't breathe and I'll never be free. It feels like your knee on my neck. We bleed for respect. Killers with dark calls, but they'll still receive a check. Racism won't end, and you don't respect my skin. Profiling on my brother. Oh, here we go again. One strike and we out. Let's carve a different route. Cause they can't relate to the shouts and screams from my mouth. We will never get ahead or fully get fed unless we do it for ourselves. I can tell that y'all scared. Still the shackles we tackle and shoot at hoops for long range. Let the white boy walk, but he illegal with his thing. We hang like strange fruit when they shoot without balls. They do the same crimes, but don't face the same laws. That's all you need to know about this country. In fact, I don't know about America, but I'm proud to be black. Think you know how I feel, but I know that you don't. Cause I ain't white with a privilege that they save me in court. Black in America feels like I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Black in America feels like I'll never be free. I'll never be free. I'll never be free. Black in America feels like I can't breathe. I can't breathe. Black in America feels like I'll never be free. I'll never be free. I'll never be free.
That was MC Longshot with Black in America with the triple K.
Another banger. Thanks, Longshot. As we've been talking about Monte and we've been talking about these police killings and the overall lack of accountability, you know, aside from the more recent high-profile killings of Derek Chauvin, Kim Potter, they were found guilty. But police continue to obscure the investigations that we've been talking about. They cover up. They don't turn their documentation over. on police killings. The feds have done databases, tried to hold databases open of police killings, and they've had to close those down because the police departments are just not sharing the information. It's just a continual lack of accountability and transparency from the police forces that we've seen. And this is like prompted international entities like the United Nations to investigate the police in America. You know, they might not have power to create any kind of consequence, but that's happened. On that topic, a recent commission of inquiry that was coordinated by international human rights lawyer Lennox Hines, who was actually Nelson Mandela's attorney while he was in the U.S. many, many years ago, took place in early 2021. So this commission actually conducted hearings on 44 cases of black people who were killed by the police. 43 who were killed by police. One was killed by somebody else. The International Commission Inquiry literally is called the International Commission Inquiry on Systemic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the United States of America. And they also featured Javis Benjamin's case.
Welcome to the hearings of the International Commission Inquiry on Systemic Racist Police Violence Against Police People of African Descent in the United States of America.
Now, during the hearing, Monte's attorney Patrick McGarrell laid out the facts in Javis's case and also the reasoning as to how police continue to get away with murder in America, pointing to the lack of accountability and qualified immunity.
We now begin with the case of Javis Benjamin. My name is Horace Campbell. I am a rapporteur for this hearing. Presiding over this hearing today is Commissioner Professor Rashida Manju of South Africa and Commissioner Bert Samuels, an attorney of Jamaica. The witnesses for the hearing are Attorney Patrick McGarrell and Miss Monte Benjamin, Javis Benjamin's mother. There'll be 50 minutes for this hearing. Witnesses will testify, followed by a period of questions from commissioners. I will call time at the 30-minute mark and at the 45-minute mark. Please excuse my interruptions. Commissioners Manju and Commissioner Samuels, I now present to you the first witness, Attorney Patrick McGarrell. Attorney McGarrell, please confirm your name.
Patrick Michael McGarrell.
Do you promise that your testimony for the Commission of Inquiry will be true to the best of your knowledge and belief?
I do.
You may begin.
Thank you very much, Madam Chairwoman, commissioners, and esteemed members of this panel. Thank you very much for having me here today. One of the things that I would like to testify about is how something like this can happen from a legal standpoint. Monte Benjamin, my client, will testify about the impact that it has had upon her and her family as the real victims in this incident, in this tragedy. But I would like to provide this commission with some background information as to how we got to where we are and some suggestions that may provide some guidance going forward on how to prevent this sort of thing in the future. First, I will like to briefly recite the facts. I know that the commission is well aware of the facts, but with some illustrations, I think some facts need to be emphasized more than others. This tragedy arises from an incident that occurred now 8 years ago on January 18th, 2013, when a police officer named Sergeant Lynn Thomas of the Avondale Estates Police Department in Georgia, United States, was on patrol. He witnessed what he claimed was a car traveling at an excessive rate of speed. He started to pursue the car, but lost sight of it as it traveled through the city of Avondale Estates. Eventually, he came upon a crash site where the car had apparently crashed into a front yard of a residence. There were no injuries. There was only property damage to the car. And Javis Benjamin was seated behind the steering wheel of the car. Thomas stopped his vehicle, exited, and immediately began shouting at Benjamin to remain in the car in a very aggressive manner. Mr. Benjamin followed these instructions, and then Thomas approached the car, shouting at him, drew his firearm, and pointed it at Mr. Benjamin. Now he changed his commands to get out of the car and pushed him down as Mr. Benjamin sat in the car. So we have some very contradictory statements here. We have first command to stay in the car, and then we have a command to get out of the car while he's simultaneously being pushed back in the car. Javis Benjamin started to climb out the window because the doors of the car were damaged. Thomas continued pointing his firearm at Benjamin and began to back up. As Mr. Benjamin got out of the car, as confirmed on video, he put his hands up and apparently looked at somebody off camera and said, "Y'all see what he's trying to do to me." At no point did he make any furtive movements. At no point did he display any aggressive behavior. As a matter of fact, Mr. Thomas backed away in a different direction than Mr. Benjamin was walking. And then the next thing you know, Officer Thomas is shooting Mr. Benjamin, who is completely unarmed and at that point had made no attempt to attack the police officer. Unfortunately, those shots proved to be fatal. And subsequently, the local prosecutor's office, which is the DeKalb County District Attorney's Office, conducted an internal investigation. A civil grand jury, not a criminal grand jury, but a civil grand jury, and the distinction is important here, under state law, was convened to hear testimony on this matter and not issue charges, but simply to conduct an investigation and recommend whether charges should be pursued or not. Mr. Benjamin's case was one of six cases that was presented to the civil grand jury. And Miss Benjamin, Monty Benjamin, several family members went to the district attorney's office, saw that there were two different versions of the video from the dashboard camera of the police car. And that is key, because the version that they saw at the district attorney's office provided a wider field of view, provided additional information that supported the theory that Javis Benjamin was shot without attacking the police officer or making any attempt to do so. However, later, subsequently, that video was cut down on the sides to restrict the field of view, to alter it and make it look as though something else had occurred off camera, which clearly did not. Nevertheless, out of the six cases presented to the civil grand jury, two out of those six cases were recommended for criminal prosecution and were recommended to convene a criminal grand jury to consider charges against the officer. Mr. Benjamin's case was one of those two cases. Unfortunately, the DeKalb County District Attorney's Office declined to present the case to a criminal grand jury and instead notified Monty Benjamin they would not be pursuing any criminal charges against Officer Thomas from the unlawful and unjustified killing of Javis Liddell Benjamin. That is when Monty Benjamin sought civil remedies under the United States Code, specifically 42 United States Code Section 1983, which is a civil rights law in the United States, and sought my services to file a lawsuit for deprivation of civil rights in the United States District Court for the Northern District of Georgia in Atlanta, Georgia. We filed that lawsuit, and Sergeant Lynn Thomas in the city of Avondale Estates responded. And unfortunately, the judge dismissed the lawsuit in December of 2017, basically ruling that the doctrine of qualified immunity prevented either the city or the police officer from being sued. We then tried to appeal to the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which upheld the ruling, and even the United States Supreme Court refused to consider the case at all. So this is where we currently stand today on January 21st, 2021, 8 years after this woman lost her son. A mother has lost her child. The community has lost a bright young man with a valuable future. The Benjamin family has lost a brother. People have lost a friend. And we sit here wondering, how does this happen? Now, over the past several months, a lot has been said about racial injustice in the United States. And I look at it from a legal point of view, that is only part of the problem. because what people living in the United States and people living outside the United States always wonder, who are not steeped in the law, not trained in the law, is how does something like this happen legally without repercussion, without consequence? How is there no consequence for killing an unarmed man? And how do the police continuously get away with it? And the answer to that question is because of American legal jurisprudence has a doctrine called qualified immunity, which is just as foreign to people outside of the United States as it is to most people in the United States. So for those of us who are unfamiliar with qualified immunity, it is a legal principle that grants government officials who perform what is called discretionary functions immunity from civil suit unless the plaintiff can show that the official violated some clearly established statutory or constitutional right, which a reasonable person would have known to be the case. And what it does is it protects government officials from being sued, except what they call the plainly incompetent or those who knowingly violate the law. The problem is, just like with all laws, there's enormous loopholes, and eventually the exception becomes the rule and the rule becomes the exception. And unfortunately, qualified immunity is no different from any of those other legal principles that always start out with the best intentions, but unfortunately get molded, reshaped, abused until they no longer have any meaning. And it's important to know that the doctrine of qualified immunity was created by the United States Supreme Court in 1967 at the height of the civil rights movement in the United States. And again, started with good intentions. And the rationale was that a law enforcement official should not be sued in frivolous lawsuits and face financial liability in cases where they acted in good faith in unclear legal situations. Since 1967, a lot has changed, and the courts have interpreted this rule very broadly to basically give police officers license to do almost anything that they want with little or no repercussion whatsoever, especially in cases involving excessive or deadly force by police. And it is no secret that the people facing the brunt of excessive or deadly force by police are frequently young Black men. There is simply no disputing that. The numbers do not lie whatsoever. The problem is that the net result has basically provided the police officers with a license to kill and basically allows them to do whatever they please because they know that in the end, there is an extraordinarily high chance that anything they do will be protected by the doctrine of qualified immunity. So then the question really becomes, how do we prevent this from happening again? And sadly, there is no way to prevent this from happening again. This will happen again. Even the most stringent laws cannot prevent that. But what I think we can do is prevent or decrease the frequency with the way these kinds of tragedies occurs, because by holding government officials and law enforcement officials to at least some standard of accountability, that will likely reduce the number of these tragedies. Right now, there is no accountability. With no accountability, there is no restraint. When there is accountability, when there are consequences for your actions, there is a strong motivation for restraint.
That was Monte Benjamin's attorney, Patrick McGarrow. He was speaking during the International Commission of Inquiry on Systemic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the U.S. Again, that was from the United Nations, an international entity that's investigating United States police for their racist terrorism against Black folks here in the United States. For the last bit of this episode, we're going to bring you back to Javis, though. Javis loved art. He had a huge passion for kids. You know, as you have mentioned earlier, even Georgia, he was a music engineer for this massive church. Like, I can't remember how much thousands of people attend that church. He was the engineer. So,
like, very talented.
Yeah, it sounded like, oh my gosh, he had the whole world in front of him. He's 20 years old.
Yeah.
But we're going to hear from his mother about some of the impacts that he had on some of the youth that he worked with.
Let me just say.
Please do.
When we interviewed Monte, and when she told us this story, my heart shattered. And I cried with her. We cried with her, you know. And so the thing that's very challenging about doing this work is that you grieve with the families. And we know that it's not just Monte who is going to forever miss Javis, but also some of the youth that he worked with. Take a listen.
The one brief story that I would share that impacted me as his mother, by him working at the Boys and Girls Club after his funeral. At his funeral, I had a 6-foot by 5-foot poster with his picture on it, but I had the trim around the picture left at everybody who attend the funeral to sign their name or to leave a message for Javis. Well, I went to the Boys and Girls Club where he worked with the kids, and I took that picture and another picture, and I allowed the kids who were teaching in his class, he was teaching in the class, to sign and to leave a message. Well, it was a 6-year-old kid that walked up to me and he said, hey, Mr. Benjamin, when is Mr. Benjamin's coming back? And when this kid said to me, when is Mr. Benjamin coming back? And I had to walk away. But there was an 8-year-old girl who wrote me a card out. And that 8-year-old girl in that card said, what she did was she walked to the kids and she said, Mr. Benjamin is not coming back. Mr. Benjamin is in heaven. And that being that he's in heaven, we gonna be all right because he gonna be looking over us. And so she went to the 6-year-old child and she said, it's gonna be all right. And it crushed me because an 8-year-old child telling a 6-year-old child, Mr. Benjamin is in heaven. I had to walk away, but it was one thing about it. The 6-year-old child came to me, but Mr. Benjamin cared for me. And that's my memory that I will never forget, is to see those two kids share the love they had for my child. So I'm finished. I'm sorry. But my son's name was Javis Benjamin. His name is spelled Javisbenjamin. He was 20 years old when he died. It was his birthday. It is 9/2/92, and it was January the 18th, 2013, and it happened on Martin Luther Day weekend.
So sad hearing Monte recount such an emotional story. But before we end the episode, we wanted to give a brief update on Lynn Thomas. As you've heard, Thomas was the officer who killed Javis and was subsequently promoted to police chief. Well, in the fall of 2021, Thomas was actually forced to retire after his Avondale Estates Police Department failed to earn state accreditation by the Georgia Association of Chiefs of Police, who cited systemic procedural failures. The accreditation manager, Lieutenant Dwayne Thompson, was the one who promoted Thomas to police chief. He actually resigned after the failed review. Avondale Estates Police Department is wrought with racism. There's about 4,000 residents in the city. About 85% of them are white. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution said that police reports show that 75% of the people ticketed and cited for driving infractions are black. And so it just shows some of the structural imbalances and racial hierarchies happening in Avondale Estates, a small town in DeKalb County, Georgia. Thank you for listening to episode 4. You can find all of the episodes at unicornriot.ninja/themothers.
And to find out more about my work as an independent journalist, head over to my website, georgiafort.com.
And you can follow my work, Nico Georgiadis, at Mr. Nico G on social media and nicog.work.
Audio recording and engineering by Malcolm Wells. You can find my work at stonywells.com and at Stony Wells on social media, STONYWELLZ.
What up? This is Longshot, and I provided the raps for the Mothers Podcast. You can support me and my work at mclongshot.com. Peace.
My name is Tariq Thornton. I help edit and produce along with DJ Skiz for Different Worlds Music Group. Peace.
My name is DJ Skiz. I made all the beats as well as did the mixing and editing of the Mothers Podcast. can check me out on social media at DJ Skizz, DJSKIZZ, or at DJSkizzBeats.com.
You could also follow Unicorn Riot across social media platforms and find our work at unicornriot.ninja. Unicorn Riot is a 501c3 educational nonprofit media organization dedicated to engaging and amplifying the stories of social and environmental struggles from the ground up. Support our work at unicornriot.ninja/donate.
Part of the funding for this podcast is made possible by the voters of Minnesota through a grant from the Metropolitan Regional Arts Council, thanks to a legislative appropriation from the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.